Welcome back to another episode of the High Existence Podcast. My name is John Brooks, and I have a few things that I want to tell you about today before we crack into today's interview. And today's interview is a very good one. But before that, there are two announcements that I want to make. The first one is, are you aware that we at High Existence create our own retreats where we combine all of the most powerful transformational modalities that we know of, from meditation to plant medicine to yoga to breathwork and everything in between? We've so far conducted 4 retreats across different parts of the world. They've been huge successes, and we have more coming in 2020. If you would like to meet us in real life and dive deep and transform and be part of a community, a tribe of like-minded individuals, visit apotheosisretreat.com, where you can learn more. The other thing, are you familiar with Stoic philosophy? I've been a huge advocate of Stoic philosophy for around 15 years. Stoicism has made a huge impact on my life, has honestly saved my life, and has helped me deal with some very, very, very difficult periods in my life. I've taught live workshops on apotheosis retreats about Stoicism. And I've put together all of my favorite ideas, exercises, challenges, guided meditations, video workshops, everything, Q&As, into what I call the Stoic Quest, which is an 8-week Stoicism obstacle course that is designed to help you actually become a Stoic instead of just know a little bit about Stoicism. If this interests you, if you want to know more about Stoicism, then visit highexistence.com/Stoic Quest. Now that's out of the way, let's crack into today's episode. Here's Mike Slavin to introduce the guest.
Welcome to the High Existence Podcast. This is Mike Slavin. I'll be your host today in this interview with Eric James. Now, Eric is a very interesting individual who's seen a lot of success, but has gone about it in very unconventional ways. He's created magic tricks that David Blaine has used. He's coded apps that have reached number one in the App Store and has started multiple successful businesses. And on this conversation, we're going to discuss with Eric how a person can engineer their own luck and how we can go about surfing serendipity to create better results in our life. So you're going to hear some stories that include cameos from people like Elon Musk and Richard Branson, and we're just going to cover some really wide-ranging territory. I'm excited for you to hear it and see how you can apply some of these principles to create a little bit more luck in your own life. So let's dive in. All right. Welcome, everyone, to the High Existence Podcast. I'm Mike Slavin, and today I'm very excited to have with me a good friend of mine. His name is Eric James. Eric, thanks for making the time to be here today.
Oh, Mike, it's great to be on. Thank you for the invitation. I'm so excited to have this conversation today.
Me too. And the plan here between Eric and I is we really want to sink our teeth into this topic of luck. Now, how do we engineer our own luck? How can we surf serendipity? And Eric has a very interesting skill set around this. He has a relationship with luck unlike anyone I've ever met before. And I'm excited for him to share some of his stories that kind of open up this space so you can start to consider and think about luck a bit differently. Now, Eric, before we really dig into the meat here, I was hoping that I could share a bit about how we met, because I think it just aligns so nicely with the topic, and it kind of, just really lends itself to the sort of magic that's happening here. Is it cool with you if I dive in a little bit and share that story?
Sure, man. Definitely. Right. I think it's a great story.
It's an amazing story. So I moved out to Boulder, Colorado about 6 years ago, and when I first came out, I was fortunate enough to be embedded in a bit of an entrepreneurial community. And I was attending these dinners where we would have these potlucks and different people would show up and we would, you know, have great conversations. And it was a really good way for me to meet people having just started my life out here in Colorado. And then there was this one day that this guy walks in and I had this strangest sensation. I felt like I had seen him before somewhere, but I know I hadn't met him before. It was like he was famous to me somehow, and I couldn't put my finger on it. I was like, who is this guy? And this guy was Eric. And I ended up striking up a conversation with him, and through over the course of the night, it finally became clear that Eric started one of the first online magic companies. And I've been practicing sleight of hand and indulging in magic for about 13 years, probably more than that now. Yeah, 15, 16 years. And so I realized, holy shit, when I was in eighth grade, I was watching Eric's videos online. And now here I am, you know, 8 years later or something like that. And he's standing in front of me. And we really hit it off and had a great conversation that night and ended up being roommates for 2 years subsequently. And so it was such a fortuitous encounter. And I think as entering into this conversation of luck and serendipity, that was one of the most serendipitous moments I've ever had. And it's always blown me away at the sort of real magic that brought two magicians together.
Absolutely, man. And that was actually a really serendipitous moment for me too. I think I've shared this with you, but how that all happened was actually, there's so many lucky occurrences, but I don't know if I want to get into that whole backstory, some of that maybe, but basically at the time I was really, really struggling. Just went through a hard breakup and was going through some panic attacks and anxiety and was basically not okay being like out in public, you know, like I just, my level of anxiety, I thought I just needed to go straight to the hospital, that kind of a vibe going on. And then a really good friend at the time, Dan Adams, was visiting Boulder, and he and I were supposed to meet up, and I wanted to still like try to make an attempt to meet up with him. We were just going to meet up at a coffee shop, and he said, hey, I'm going over to this entrepreneur dinner. You should stop by. And it was super intimidating to me, the idea of doing that and being sort of in a group of brand new people that all know each other and I don't know anybody and of other, you know, successful entrepreneurs and stuff. So, but then I was like, no, I just have to go for this. Like, I just got this sensation and I really trust Dan and know that he, you know, has love for me and have my best interest in mind. And I'm not going to walk into any kind of bad situation. And I'm so glad that I decided to push through the limits of my fears at the time and what I was going through, because walking in there, it was like the most welcoming, friendly, amazing group of people, starting with you, that, you know, I'd maybe even ever been around. And it was completely life-changing. And it, you know, you kind of saw me as a stronger point in my life. And so it helped me remember, oh, wow, you know, maybe I don't have to be this anxious or heartbroken or all these kind of things. And then you and another, you know, entrepreneur friend of ours, like, invited me to live in a house with you guys. And at the time, I was living alone in the place where I had all these memories with my ex and all this stuff. So getting out of that environment and getting into the environment with you guys literally, like, saved my life. Like, that was incredible. And it enabled me to climb out of the hole that I was in at the time. And that entrepreneurial community in Boulder was just incredible as well. And, you know, even that weekend going to the toga party where there was the Olympic, you know, we had like Mount Olympus games and all this craziness, and just there was just so much positive energy and beautiful women, and I'm sure the women would say beautiful men, and it was just like a very alive group of people with a lot of love and a lot of ambition, and just being around that energy is just like swallowed up any darkness that I had. So that was incredibly good timing and lucky and serendipitous, and I'm so grateful for it, and it's so cool to hear that you were so grateful for it too on the other side.
Oh yeah, and I encourage anyone who's listening to this who might be going through a rough time and might not see a clear pathway out, there all the time there are these things that happen in life that become these plot twists, these curveballs that you could never anticipate, whether it's attending a dinner party or you meet someone on the street, and then it just changes the whole trajectory. So just remember to hold the faith, and life can surprise you. Just keep showing up, keep pushing through those thresholds, and things can turn around quite dramatically and much faster than you might expect. And so, yeah, just it's so worth keeping that in mind. And so I'd love to just, you have so many excellent stories that I've heard from, you know, in the time of knowing you. I'd just love to venture into some of this territory of these sort of insane encounters with luck. I'm curious, is there a particular story that you really hold as sort of the crown jewel in terms of your explorations with serendipity and luck that you feel like is the one that really conveys your relationship to it in the best way?
There's a couple. I think the Elon Musk story is a pretty good one. I have some other ones too, but okay. I can start with that one.
Hit us with Elon, yeah.
So I'm trying to think exactly where to start this story. This was in a after a previous breakup, actually. Basically had a business partner end up leaving me about $200,000 in debt. And I bought the company, but then there was unpaid debts that basically I agreed to pay as a part of the contract, but I didn't know, the quantity.
Yeah.
Basically. Basically it was unpaid taxes, and I agreed to pay the taxes, but I didn't know there was past unpaid taxes. And so I acquired this company from a business partner, and then my girlfriend at the time and I were gonna run it, and then I find out that the business is basically not in as good a shape as I thought, and owe $200,000 now in debt. And then she left. So this is a different relationship than I was referring to before. So I've had some up and downs in relationships too, as I guess we all have, right? Mm-hmm. But I literally went from living in like a pretty nice place in downtown Denver with the girl I thought I was going to marry, and everything was going good. We're going to try to buy this company from a business partners, and then my girlfriend and I were going to grow it together. And then, use that passive income to travel the world and, use the advertising dollars to build up credit card miles and all that stuff. And so, we had this master plan, and then all of a sudden the master plan completely went to crap. And I'm $200,000 in debt. I can't afford the apartment anymore. So I just had to move out immediately. I moved back to Boulder from Denver. And then the place I moved into was a much cheaper apartment, and it turned out it had bed bugs. Mm. And so I literally kind of lost my best friends who were my business partners, my girlfriend, the business, all my money. And then now I'm in an apartment with bed bugs, and I wake up and I just have red marks all over me, and I'm completely itchy. And all I want to do is go to a friend's house and just have some support or whatever, and I'm, since I'm all heartbroken, and I can't, because they're like, I don't, no offense, but I don't really want bed bugs, and no one would come over to my place because they didn't want bed bugs either. And so it amplified the feeling of just needing other people's support. And so I basically just fell into a puddle of Eric. I was just like, I don't want to be an adult today. This is this sucks. How the hell am I supposed to get out of this? And then it kind of hit me that it couldn't get any worse. And so I popped in some Tony Robbins tapes, which are very motivating for me and have been a huge source of guidance and inspiration for me, especially in challenging times. And I did one of his goal setting sessions. And I set these most ridiculous goals because I had no belief that they would happen at the time, because if I looked at my situation, I didn't see a lot of positive evidence. And I was like, I would love to be a National Geographic photographer and traveling the world to all these exotic places and really taking these amazing images of celebrating what's right in the world. Like the news and everyone's just covering what's wrong. I want to remind people what's glorious about this planet so that we connect to that and then help save it, basically. And so then another goal I had was like to meet Elon Musk, and I really wanted to test the Roadster. So I was like, oh, it'd be so cool to meet Elon Musk and get to talk to him about space and Tesla and everything, and then be able to like have like a Tesla Roadster. I thought that was the coolest car in the world at the time. Oh, and this was during the middle of the economic collapse too.
If so, things weren't already worse enough.
Yeah, so just for context, it was in 2007 that this was all happening. The crazy thing is I set those goals, and then without knowing how they were going to happen. But just by setting those, writing them down, I printed out a picture of the Tesla Roadster and put it on my wall. I picked out the camera that I wanted, like which is like a digital Hasselblad, which is like this crazy camera. The like original version is what they took the pictures of the moon. And basically, I found myself 2 weeks later. Well, let me think of how to tell the story. So basically, within 2 weeks, I had come up with a new pricing model for the business and gotten an investment in the business of $260,000. And then I find myself in a gallery in downtown Boulder, and there was an artist named Jen Lewin, and she does these really amazing art installations for Burning Man. And she had one, I think it was called The Pond. And it's basically these discs that light up, and as one person steps on one, it changes. It's like a ripple of colors through wirelessly to all these other pads. It's super cool. And she wanted to get an aerial photograph. And this is 2007, so there's not really drones yet, but I like love to fly RC airplanes and RC helicopters and stuff. So, and I love photography. And so we were talking about the idea of how to get an overhead view of this art installation, like put it out in a field and take overhead pictures of it. And so she invited me to come to the gallery and just check it out. It's a closed gallery. They were just checking out the pond. It wasn't like an art opening or anything like that. And so I walk into this art gallery with my friend Matt, and then Elon's mom walks up to me, and she's like, hi, you know, and I didn't know at the time that's who it was, but it's pretty cool now. And then Elon Musk walks up to me, and he's like, hi, I'm Elon. And I was like,
I know.
I'm Eric, you know, and it was so funny because I like wanted to like have this amazing conversation, and it was actually just super awkward because he's so smart that any question I asked him, he just answered it. So I'd be like, what are you doing for this thing in this rocket? And he would just answer it with a one-word answer or two-word answer, which was correct. But it wasn't like conversational. It didn't like add anything. Like an improv, you know, you always want to give the next thing for the next person to kind of go off of. There was none of that. But luckily, my friend Matt is a little better emotional intelligence in social situations than me. So he actually just started talking about like movies. And then we had a totally normal conversation, which was cool, about movies. which was so funny to like talk about a topic that wasn't his expertise.
Yeah.
But just I had to like keep pinching myself. They were sitting there at the gallery talking to Elon Musk. So we have a friend, Nate Vanderchaff, who is really into electric cars, like way more than me. And he set up in the the primaries for the election. Back then electric cars were not a you know big thing yet, so we could drive all the delegates around in the electric cars. So we brought all the electric cars from around the country, or Nate did to be specific. We drove people around in them. He organized all this to actually drive the delegates around in electric cars at the DNC to prove that this could actually happen. So we text Nate and we're like, hey dude, like Elon is here at this gallery, get over here. Like just pretend that you're supposed to be here. So he shows up and then kind of joins the conversation. We're talking about movies. And then he's like, Elon, do you know about the Colorado tax credit? And Elon's like, well, yeah, you know, all states or most states have a tax credit and there's a federal tax credit. And he's like, well, Colorado's is specific where it's specifically worded where Colorado will pay the difference for the next closest car to the electric version. So, for example, a Lotus Elise is the closest thing at the time to a Tesla Roadster. And so a Tesla Roadster costs $120,000 and a Lotus Elise only costs $60,000, meaning Colorado would pay $60,000 difference. And Elon didn't know that. And so basically, they took advantage of that, set up a gallery in Boulder, and then Colorado was basically what saved Tesla, because they had to get all the cars sold by December 31st and delivered by December 31st. They sold enough in Colorado because Colorado investors and people who wanted this saw the opportunity. They could buy a Tesla, and if they loved it and it was great, they could keep it. But if they decided not to, they could actually sell it for a profit.
Because
it would go down in value, but not cut in half.
Yeah. So that was a no-brainer opportunity for people who are even a little bit interested. It's like, what do you have to lose? Like, nothing. You have so much to gain.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So basically they did that, and it was amazing because Elon flew back into town a couple times, so I got to hang out with him a couple more times, which is so crazy. And then actually placed an order for anthracite gray with black rims, like super sick Tesla Roadster, which was delivered like as a Christmas present that year. And so I don't know if you guys are listening to, you know, if the listeners or if Mike, if you picked up on this too, but the math on that was crazy. So I got a $260,000 investment, and I was $200,000 in debt, right? So if you subtract that $200,000, you got $60,000. The Tesla Roadster was $120,000, but it had a $60,000 tax credit on it. So I was able to go from negative $200 to actually driving a Tesla Roadster for a year in a way that was profitable, and then sell it a year later.
Wow.
And like had, you know, and I was still actually at, you know, $0 or whatever, but luckily we were able to turn the business around, and the business didn't do anything gigantic, but we were able to move the needle enough to, you know, produce enough income for me to live off of. I don't know if I want to get into the other story that happened with this, the Branson story, or.
Yeah, maybe we dive into that, but I want to take a moment to sort of unpack what happened here, because it's so wild. It's like hard to believe even that this, like, you wrote these things down, and now next thing you know, you're shaking hands with Elon. And I'm just wondering, you know, because someone could be listening to this and they'd say, well, this guy's lucky, but I'm not, you know, that would never happen to me. You know, we all have these ways of sort of disqualifying ourselves outside of, you know, some of these experiences we might want to have. And I think that is the very thing that begins to close people off from the experience of, you know, getting lucky and actually experiencing more serendipity. And so, are there things that you feel like really contributed to those events transpiring? Would you say it was just complete, just dumb chance? It was just a coincidence and that's all it was? Or was there something, some way that you were showing up that was supporting in that whole sort of confluence of events to happen? What would you say?
That one is the most sort of lucky, where it's hard to blame it on anything else or give anything else credit, so to speak. But absolutely, I think there are elements that are consistent where, despite my despair at the time, I was taking massive action and I was interacting and I was adding value, right? So like I'm trying to help this artist get these images of her, of her artwork, do these aerial photography. So I'm like working inside of my passion. I'm interacting with other people. There's things like being bold. So one of the biggest things that I think makes these things happen for me is that bigger goals are actually much, much easier to achieve than small goals, which is super counterintuitive, but they actually require a lot less risk too. So I was doing all those things. I was bold. Like when I made those goals, they weren't like small goals. They were like huge goals. And so I was being bold, and then I was taking a lot of action, and then I was getting myself in proximity. I didn't know it at the time, but basically Jen Lewin, she never changed her name because as an artist, she wanted to keep the name. At least that's my assumption. And then, but she was actually married to Kimbal Musk, Elon's brother. And that's why Elon was there. But like, I didn't know that at the time. But if I had, that would have been a great strategy, right? If you're like, huh, this person that's in the community that I'm a part of is this person I want to meet's brother. Not that you have to be manipulative about it or anything like that, but it's like you could add value to that situation. And those are just still human beings that, are a part of the community. So it doesn't have to be like a negative thing whatsoever. And we absolutely did add value to Elon. I mean, we probably at least played a major role in saving Tesla because they were able to get the financing they needed because of those sales in Colorado, at least from what I've heard from Tesla insiders. I would love to ask Elon if that's true or not. But
Elon, if you're listening, reach out. Let us know.
Yeah, let us know.
Come on the podcast.
But yeah, I've heard from people when I've told this story that actually worked at Tesla, and they're like, that, you know, yeah, like without that, we wouldn't have gotten the financing, and that was the key. So it's kind of cool that, you know, being bold and setting these goals, which seems pretty selfish kind of now looking back, but they were genuine. It was things that were inspiring to me for sure. Actually did contribute not only to me, but actually contributed to something I'm passionate about and hopefully society as well. But yeah, so taking action and then kind of living by my code of conduct and being really bold. So like, despite how much pain I was in, still taking action and still going after what I wanted and still being audacious enough to set those goals, I think absolutely played a role.
Yeah, and to be clear, this Colorado tax credit is no longer no longer, you know, on the table. If someone's listening to this and they're excited to make a profit on a resale of a Tesla, that window is closed, correct?
Yeah, that's closed. So it actually, they realized pretty quickly that was not the right way to word the tax credit thing, and so they had it, you know, it was expiring that year. And so that's why everything had to be done by December 31st, which was, you know, only, I don't know, 4 months later or something. So I think one of the concepts here too that I want to hit on is, I think people are starting to be familiar with this idea of a black swan. Mm-hmm. Have you heard that saying before?
Yeah, I have.
So like an unexpected bad surprise, something that you don't expect and sort of not in your model of reality, but can have really negative effects. And what people don't realize is that white swans, or, you know, maybe neon green swans or something, like a positive version, are just as likely. And, you know, but you have to be doing things and putting yourself in situations where unexpected things can happen. Otherwise, good thing, you know, you can't get lucky on the upside if there's no randomness, if you're not actually putting yourself in opportunity, like increasing your luck surface area, as you like to say. And so one of the things that's been challenging for me, or something I notice, is like, I want to control things and I want to control how things will happen. And when I do, no luck happens and things are a lot harder because I don't have that unexpected upside that kind of gives me the boost in whatever it is I'm trying to do. But when I let go of control a little bit of how it's going to happen, I pick the direction but not the path, then I have this opportunity. Sure, bad things can happen, and they do, but also good things can happen, and they do. And so I think that's a huge lesson for me that's taken me a lot of years to really realize, is that hanging on too tight prevents good things from happening to you as well.
Absolutely. There's so much to say here. So I'm going to address that last point and then circle back to some of these other concepts that you're illuminating that I think are so useful. And connected to this piece about the controlling mind, we want to engineer these plans. We want to create these blueprints that we're like, you know, step one, step two, step three. We can see the path into the future. And in a lot of ways, I think this is something that is not even necessarily to arrive at those places. It's something that we develop to hold on to in the present moment to quell our anxieties. Because the in the face of a completely uncertain future, it's really hard for us to sort of cope with and swallow. But like you're saying, if we're really tight-fisted around that, then it puts on the blinders and it makes it hard for us to see those neon green swans, or to even expose ourselves to the likelihood that they, like, to create a greater range for those things to flow into our lives. And so I think it's wonderful to have a plan, but it's just knowing that plan is in its very nature going to be updated, because our plans aren't, we're co-authoring with life. We're not the only one with our hand on the pen, right? So there's these surprises and these things that emerge that really can further and support the growth of our projects and our plans, if we could only just allow ourselves to remain open to them. And this connects me with a lot of what I'm hearing as you're describing this story. I mean, one of the things that I really love, and I think this is so essential, is that you were still engaging with the things that made you excited and lifted you up and made you come alive. It would have been so easy for you to construct a story where you are just, you know, down, like, you know, of course you went through this sort of downturn, but to just build out this victim narrative where, oh, poor me, I'm in all of this debt, I'm just so screwed. And because of that, just completely, you know, kind of cut yourself off from those things that were driving enthusiasm, the things that you did care about. You didn't close yourself off from those things. You still allowed yourself to go through into these avenues of excitement. And when people see someone who's engaging with things that they really love to do, there's something infectious about that. We love when people are like super stoked on something, because we get to, that gets to rub off on us. We get to benefit from their joy. And so I really love that you were able to sort of pull yourself up from that and just keep moving forward and in whatever ways you knew how at the moment, to just kind of start chipping away and like sort of digging yourself out of the hole, so to speak. It would be very easy for someone to just kind of stay there curled up in a ball, you know, afraid to move. And that was pretty, you know, beastly set of, you know, circumstances. Like the term perfect storm, I feel like, very, very well, applies to that kind of moment you were living in. And I think this other piece, and I would love to get a little bit more context, because people are probably listening and you say bigger goals are easier to accomplish than easier goals. So how could that be? It is extremely counterintuitive. Can you share more about why that is the case? Why, like, what's the case for setting those big goals versus working on something that's smaller?
So yeah, my experience at least has been that there's a lot less competition. So, you know, the big goals out there, you know, if you're talking about, I don't know, yeah, whatever it is for you, whatever that big goal would be, if you think about the number of people in the world who are genuinely taking that on with some seriousness, that they intend to achieve that, or they're at least going to give it a shot, they're going to take action in towards that direction. It's like 0.1% of humans in the world, maybe less than that, usually less than that. And then if you look at like how many people are applying for jobs at like your local Target or Walmart or whatever, you know, just like a normal store, you know, there's probably very significant competition there for you to get that job. You know, it's probably like, you know, you probably have a less probability of getting that job than I did of meeting Elon Musk, which is weird to say. But and then the other thing is that big goals come with the obvious nature of there will be some roadblocks or some hurdles or some challenges to achieve that goal. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the Elon story is maybe not the best example of this, but some of my other stories, I think, illustrate a little better. But if you hit these challenges, and this big goal is driving you, that's really incredible and really stimulating as far as like, so for me, like the National Geographic one, or, you know, going to space to take these photographs and doing these kind of things, are such big goals and so exciting that if I get like one no from someone, I email National Geographic and they're like, no, we already have plenty of photographers or something. I'm not going to be as turned off by that, because my goal is so much bigger than that by proportion. I know that likely, you know, if I'm trying to cross a giant mountain and I'm trying a couple different paths to find the valley through there, like it might take a few tries to find the optimal route. And so I think those two factors are like a major piece of it. You know, you've got plenty of fuel because it's such a big goal. You're willing to face obstacles because you expect them. And then there's literally just less competition. It's easier than the easy things. Probability, at least, is better, I think.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Yeah, there's this real sense of, you know, if in terms of, you know, thinking about North Stars, you're setting a goal. You pick the dimmest star you can find in the sky, or do you pick the one that's really, you know, shining bright that you can see so clear and so vividly. And it just, like, those things that are so massive and that feel so large but come with such excitement. I mean, there's this almost gravitational pull that comes with that, that supports in the face of those roadblocks. And I think you're so right about those expectations. If you're applying for a job you really don't care about and you get turned down, it's easier to be disappointed because you kind of expect to get in easily, you know? But if you're doing something that requires so much more energy and is something that you really care about, then who cares if it's hard at first? You're still going to continue to show up pushing through it because it matters to you in some deep and profound way. And I think the idea that there is less competition is so counterintuitive to people, but you can just think of, you know, how often do people undercut themselves or sell themselves short and don't even get out on the playing field? I mean, how many people who are listening, if you're really honest with yourself, are you sitting on the bench right now in different ways in your life? You're not really getting out there. You're not really going for it. What would happen?
That's true. A lot of times people will sort of try something, but they're not actually intending to win, or they're not actually intending to complete that challenge. They're sort of like, I'm going to try it and see what happens, which is fine. That's a lot better than not doing anything. But it helps to, when you set out to intend to achieve your goal. And so if you're playing a game, just watch how often you're like, oh, I'll just play this, versus if you're like, I intend to win this game, and so I'm going to do what's necessary to try to win. Winning is a bad example, but it's sort of like, if you don't believe it's possible and then you try, you're going to do totally different things than if you believe it's possible, but you just don't know how yet. Then you're going to try way different things. And so it comes down more to having that faith that it's possible than it does with, I don't know. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Because if you don't believe it's possible, you're going to try and prove yourself right. And it sort of allows you, it creates this space for someone to not really give their all, because that's what I think it is. It's a bit of a justification. Like, I don't have to really put in the most amount of energy, because this would hurt so much more if I put in 100% and still didn't get it. That would really sort of make me feel vulnerable and hurt. So I'm not really going to try, and I don't really think it's going to happen. And this will kind of keep me safe in my sort of bubble here. And so to be able to really, like, say yes, no, this is possible, I'm someone who can do this, That's an amazing disposition and stance to take, and it really sort of opens up a person to have these kinds of serendipitous encounters that, like, you wouldn't even believe.
Yeah.
Some people listening to this, please believe that this isn't just something that happens to some people. You can willfully put yourself in circumstances that begin to, you know, crazy things start to happen where you wouldn't even believe. You know, you meet this person and they introduce you to somebody else. And these kinds of network effects, the way that we can plug into people and those sort of existing social ecosystems, things can accelerate incredibly rapidly. Part of it's just a matter of putting yourself out there and exploring the world and being sort of diligent and earnest in your attempts at creating the life that you want. And there's something infectious and contagious about that. But I think that you have so many other great stories. So let's shift gears and dive into, the one you mentioned earlier. Let's sink our teeth into the Branson narrative.
Yeah. So this one is kind of like proving to me more that there's something really to this, which hopefully will do the same thing for anyone that's listening too. But so after I, you know, had, you know, turned the company around and had a new investor, a new pricing model, the business is working decently well, I now have a Tesla Roadster and all this kind of stuff. The next thing on my list of my goal was to become this, international landscape photographer and everything like that, which I did, which is incredible. And I was actually able to sell the Tesla and then buy this digital Hasselblad. And I found myself at NASA underneath the Saturn rocket, you know, having dinner with Buzz Aldrin and like all this incredible stuff. And he was talking about this effect of when astronauts go to space, they always come back environmentalists. And I thought that was really fascinating. Like, what is it about seeing Earth from space that gives that impression? And kind of what hypnotized me was the idea of if you were scouring the universe, like if we were scouring the universe looking for like our utopia, like a perfect planet to settle down on as a human race, and we came upon Earth, we would be like, oh my God, we hit the jackpot. Like this thing, place is incredible. Like there's dolphins and waterfalls and like there's deserts. There's like all this variety. There's all this plant animal life. Like it's beautiful. There's all these different colors. There's hot places and cold places. And it's just like unbelievable. Oh yeah. And it's all the resources that we could ever need are like right here. Like as long as we don't waste them, there we have plenty of everything we could ever need. And it's the right distance from the sun. And the sun is giving us all the energy we could ever need, things like this. And that if we had that mindset of maybe we came from somewhere desolate and dry like Mars or, you know, something like that, and we came upon Earth and that we lived here, if someone dropped one piece of trash, we would smack them upside the head and be like, hey, like this is, like you don't do that in heaven, you know?
What the hell, man?
Yeah, like, so the idea is like, you know, what if we're in heaven, but we forgot?
Hmm.
Like, what if this is heaven and we just forgot and we're turning it into to hell for ourselves? Or we can, just kind of a personal choice but and a societal choice. But yeah, I believe this could be a utopia, and it's got a lot of the ingredients of what people would describe as like a utopia. The place with all their friends where, you know, they can explore and have these adventures and, you know, share these things and have the resources, have, you know, no scarcity, have all the resources they need. It's like, we literally do have all that stuff. So, anyway, I was on a flight on an airplane, and I was actually going through like the same Tony Robbins goal setting workshop, actually the same like tape, and I was listening to it on the airplane. And so I was writing out this whole vision of like, man, I would love to like actually go to space and then take photographs of Earth and do these like, abstract light paintings and like try to evoke this emotion in people of the journey, like kind of photographically tell the journey of like searching out for a new planet, a new home, and then finding this utopia and then slowly revealing that it's Earth where we already are, and have this gallery that you go through and have this whole experience. And so I was just kind of writing it all down, and then I wrote down sort of the, as our friend Phil says, the dumb action, the simplest possible action that I could take. And that was just to check Richard Branson's Twitter account because I heard that he had a space company. So I basically, as soon as the plane landed, this was before planes had internet, the plane landed, I turned my phone off airplane mode, I check his Twitter account, and then he's having an event for Virgin Atlantic in Miami in a couple days to celebrate the 15th anniversary of Virgin Atlantic flying from Miami to London. And there's going to be a charity event beforehand. And so I see my opportunity. So I book a ticket, get in contact with Virgin Unite, which is the charitable arm, and basically say, like, you know, I want to be involved. Like, how do I get into the charity event ahead of time and everything like that? And so I was able to make a donation. I had actually made a donation to a participating charity that they support already. Through the company I had previously spoken about, we always gave away 10% of our income to charity. So we did a lot of cool stuff, building libraries and all this kind of stuff. So anyway, so again, through something previously I had taken action on, kind of created this opportunity, just taking a dumb action, or in other words, an action you can't fail at, checking Richard Branson's Twitter account. And then I see an opportunity to get in proximity and to be bold and to take action, which are all things that increase your luck surface area. So I immediately just booked a ticket to Miami, and I figured worst case scenario, I'm out a couple $100 and hopefully maybe I'll get to meet Richard Branson. I don't know. But then I find myself in Miami at the Versace mansion in the study. It's like straight out of a game of Clue with the moving ladders and smells of mahogany and everything. Like exactly like that. Ron Burgundy would have loved it. And it's just me and like a bunch of other entrepreneurs and like hustlers and people who saw the same opportunity to get in proximity. And basically it was like 10 of us, and then Branson's going to come in the room. And then I start getting nervous and I start thinking like, who am I to ask Branson for anything? And my plan is to pitch him on the idea of everything I just shared, and like, can I get a ride to space? Like, I want to do these photographs on your spaceship. And then I start getting nervous, like, who am I to ask for that? You know, I haven't been doing photography professionally for that long. You know, I don't know. I just felt like I hadn't like paid my dues, or I'm like not worthy or something like that, which absolutely can get in the way of, you know, anyone who's listening, if you know, that kind of gets in the way. But luckily a plot twist happened that I would have never expected, which is Branson walked in the room and he said, listen, we all gathered around, you know, everyone stopped talking. He said, listen, if you got yourself in this room, that matters to me. Like, I want to hear what you're up to and how I can possibly help.
Wow.
And so we literally sat in a circle and went one at a time, like complete focus and pure listening from Branson with his entrepreneur cap on and his inspiration cap on. I mean, he was really there, like really giving his energy to each and every person. And I'd never seen someone being the way he was being. And it was like, that was the greatest gift of that evening, was like, that is why he's so successful. That is incredible. And he was contributing. And I think he actually set that up kind of on purpose like that, where it's a way for him to actually get in touch with what's happening and what like young people and entrepreneurs and movers and shakers are doing, thinking about. And so, I mean, he gets tons of ideas from that. And he might get business partners out of it and all this. So it's like really good for him. And so that changed obviously my whole perspective. I'm like, oh, he wants me to tell him. This is awesome. So I give the pitch of a lifetime and I'm telling about the dolphins and the waterfalls and I'm doing all this. And it was so funny because he just stopped and he's like, well, what if your photos suck? Like, what if you're a bad photographer? Which was like not exactly the response I wanted. But he was like, yeah, show me, find me at the party later. And then show me some of your photos. And so I was like, okay. But I was like, was that a good response or bad? You know, kind of didn't respond at all to the whole story that I was, you know, saying. So we went around the rest of the room. But yeah, so I found him at the party, which was great because then I got to hang out with he and his wife and Ellie Goulding for like the rest of the night because I was with him at the party basically. And so I showed him my photographs, and I'll never forget, like the second photograph I scrolled to, he was like, this is incredible. Let's do this. This is amazing. Wow. And then he took me to his assistant and he said, connect Eric with the team at Virgin Galactic, which was incredible. And so he did. And they, you know, I had many calls with the Virgin Galactic team. Unfortunately, they had many problems and then, you know, a crash, and they're working incredibly hard to get back in the air. And they've had some test flights now, this year, literally, where they're getting back in there. I talked to the CEO via email about 6 months ago, and he knows that my hat is still in the ring and I still want to do this, but they've kind of cut off all promotional anything until they like get everything up and running, just because they've had so many challenges. So I don't know if it's gonna occur or not, but just the experience of getting to like meet Richard Branson, be in that environment, see how he was with me and others, and just him saying yes, I mean, to this crazy idea, it's totally wild. And these are all these goals that basically like set like that one time, you know, meet Elon Musk, you know, get, you know, become a photographer. And then it kind of led to the next stage of goals. And it's just like, every time I do this process, this like unbelievable magic stuff happens, and it doesn't end up always exactly the way I expect it to. And I certainly couldn't have imagined the way that those stories would have unfolded. But yeah. So that's a pretty crazy one.
Wow. Yeah. So, I mean, even if you haven't been up in space just yet, but the fact that you have carved a legitimate pathway, like it's a real pathway that is, you can see it and you're in contact with the people who make it happen. And it's just, you know, there's like, basically they're working out the kinks on their side in order for it to come to fruition. So we'll see if it ever happens. But I love that story, and I love the part where Richard kind of gives you some flack. Like, what if your pictures suck? Like, if this was a TV show or a movie, I could see that being the moment when, like, the music stops and your face drops, and it's like, oh no, like, was my pitch like that bad? It didn't work. And it's like, to have that sort of moment of depletion, just to make the moment of him saying yes so much sweeter, I think is really cool. You know, it's like sometimes we don't even realize, what if this little bit of disappointment is just a, you know, sweetener that hasn't matured yet, you know, that it's just, we don't know that this is going to make some moment down the line so much better, because I felt like, you know, more was at stake or it wasn't going to happen. And then for it to happen, it's just like, wow, so amazing. So I had the privilege of living with Eric for a couple of years, and some of his work was in the house, and I recommend checking out some of his photography. Is it okay if I share the website? I'm not sure if you keep your cool. So it's jamesazor.com. We'll have the link in the show notes. But yeah, you can start to see some of these photos and understand why Branson was really stoked. Which one was the photo that you showed him that he was so bedazzled by?
Let's see. So I showed him, I think, it's called Guardian, and it's one on the website. If you click on the portfolio, and then it's a it's like a peach, like orange looking interior. It's like a villa in Isla Capri in Italy, looking out at Mount Vesuvius. And then I think maybe there's one from Hawaii called Nurture, which is like a taro field with like a sunset and like these big mountains in the background, with like one red taro plant in the forefront. I think those are probably the two. I had kind of my whole portfolio, and I was just kind of flipping through, but those two I probably put first because they're a couple of my favorite.
Yeah, amazing. And so the piece, I mean, this was more of like a detail in this larger story, but you became a photographer, and did you take photos for National Geographic as well?
Not quite, what I did was basically, you know, one way to have that happen is they have contests all the time online, and you can submit your photographs. And so I submitted photographs for a long time, and then I had one photograph from Spain called the Blue Room Remembers that was chosen by the National Geographic editor, and then it was put in National Geographic, the photo edition, and it was like in their chosen gallery online. And so I did have a photograph in National Geographic, which was freaking crazy.
That was I say exciting. That counts.
But ironically, that was way harder. Yeah. And it makes sense because it was like a lot of people have that goal. Mm-hmm. It was way harder than like convincing Branson to go to space or like getting Tesla or any of that. Like that was the hardest of any of the goals.
Wow. So cool.
Kind of funny.
Yeah, yeah. And I love this. I want to circle back to this whole vision that you have of the photos and that kind of effect, you know, the overview effect, I believe, is what they call that sort of psychological phenomenon that happens to the astronauts, you know, seeing the pale blue dot suspended in space and recognizing, wow, this is our home, and seeing it without the boundaries and the borders and all of the stuff that can so deeply divide us, and just seeing it there in all its preciousness, I think it's so important to have that recognition. And what I love about this idea is that it's a real portal and gateway into awe. And there's this, you know, what we know about awe, I mean, this whole, you know, subject matter is so, you know, deeply interesting to me. But very often when people have these moments of awe, it's like their self-concept sort of short circuits, like the vastness of what they're encountering is so, it's just so magnificent that the circuitry, the sort of modeling of the world that the person is using at that moment can't handle it, and it sort of overloads their ability to accommodate the stimuli, and it sort of short circuits the sort of self-processing unit, and they become, you know, are more immersed in the world beyond the boundaries of their just individual self. and start to feel this deeper sense of an interdependence of being connected. And this is why this sort of sense of time famine disappears in states of awe, where people now then feel like, oh, I've like, because you're in a more timeless state, you're not so like compressed with all of the day-to-day, daily to-dos and just all of the things, you know. We're so, we get caught in these processes of just nexting and being so future-oriented that we feel so compressed in the how much time that we have in this modern world. And experiences of awe create that sense of timelessness. It promotes pro-social behavior. People are more likely to want to help others because they feel themselves as more interdependently, you know, connected to the world, not just in their own sort of flesh suit, just sitting there acting like you know, they are just this little being with that's completely alienated. And I think what you're, you know, a lot of people make the case for psychedelics being a portal or a gateway into people having these experiences. And one thing that's interesting that we've discovered with psychedelics is if you take them and you don't have a mystical experience, a lot of the positive benefits you don't receive. And so there are people who are theorizing that it is the experience of awe that is generating the healing power inside of the psychedelic states, and the psychedelics actually just make it more likely and make you more available to have those experiences of awe. And what I am hearing is this whole project of yours, this vision that you have of sort of reawakening people to the utopia under their feet is a project of inspiring and instigating that awe through the use of photography, which in its own way is such a crazy accomplishment that we've developed this technology to freeze moments in time and then like print them out and put them places and keep it forever. I mean, that's pretty wild as it is, and to kind of guide people along this path. I think it's such a beautiful vision, and I really hope that someday you find yourself up there snapping shots, and so, and I'd be very excited to see, you know, to step foot in that gallery and really have that experience myself.
Absolutely, man. I'm really looking forward to it. And I'm also really excited about the Dear Moon project. Have you heard of that?
I have not.
So Elon came out with something, a similar project very recently, where there's a multi-billionaire from Japan, I believe. And he's basically taking five artists to the moon to basically share, express through art what that's like and what space is like. And I'm hoping that some of them take on some of this too, of like expanding on the idea of Earth as utopia, or at least celebrating what it is like to come home to Earth after being in space and seeing what we really have here. So I'm hoping either I can be a part of that, or that can be another project that supports the same kind of a theme that can create this awe that you're talking about, which I think, yeah, clearly it worked, right? You can just statistically measure all the astronauts or people who have been to space and see their political, environmental, basically values and beliefs change from that experience. And so, and I believe in a positive way. I'm excited about that. That's not just me working towards this goal as well.
Yeah, and there's a really awesome sort of brief documentary, short film on the overview effect. We have it on High Existence. I'll add that link to the show notes because it's worth watching, and it shows the real value and importance of inspiring the kind of effect that you're talking about. So, yeah, love it. I'm really excited to check out that Dear Moon project. You should give Elon a call, and you know, maybe if you have any more tax credit insight, you can let him know, and you know,
totally.
We'll say, Eric, you're going to be one of the artists.
Yeah, hey, remember me?
Yeah, remember me? So one thing I want the listeners to understand is that you're a very multidimensional kind of guy. I've always been impressed by your sort of, you know, you're seem to be by nature a polymath. You were engineering magic tricks and then coding apps that were number one on the app store, and then building businesses and what are other things that you've done? Yeah, taking photographs. There's all of these different places that you've injected your enthusiasm. And I'm wondering, what do you think that is in you that has you so sort of interested and involved in so many different domains? Is there something, is it an innate curiosity that has drawn you into them? Is it something else? What do you find is the driving force that kind of has you exploring such, you know, sort of polar opposites sometimes, you know, to be an artistic photographer, but yet also to be interested in hedge fund investing? It's just things that don't necessarily seem compatible, fit inside of this one human being that I'm speaking to. Why do you think that is? What is it in you that's doing that?
I don't know. I mean, it's hard because like you like to say, I have unlimited access to myself, so I think it's normal. whereas other people think it's different or something.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I mean, I think I got really lucky that I couldn't ever really get a job anywhere. And I think that really played a role. Also, I did terrible in school. So like traditional paths didn't work for me. So I had to find other ways, and it put me into weird situations where there'd be these little pockets of wonderfulness and success with whatever it is I was trying to do or learn. Or for example, like I loved skating, like skateboarding, rollerblading, like BMX, except I sucked at them. And I would switch between them because I wanted to be good and like I loved it. But then what I did was really get into filmmaking. Because I was good at that, and then I could film my friends who were some of the best skaters of the day, and then make, you know, skate videos. And then that was my first business, was like selling these skate videos at skate parks, and like and that did well. Like that was a good business. And so yeah, I think it's like I got rewarded in life from doing things my own way, and that I don't know, it's like I followed the little hints that were laid out for me. So like there are all these times where this little portal opens for all of us where it's like, hey, I want to know what's over there. But you're like, hey, you know what? I'm trying to focus. I'm trying to go this direction. I have a plan. I'm pretty good at just jumping through the portal and just saying like, there's a portal over there. It's called photography. I'm going to go ahead and jump through that portal. And I don't know, man, just like I get extremely passionate about things. So, you know, when I get into something, it's like I can't stop thinking about it. I just have to learn every single thing I can about it. I just like want to go do it and just expose myself to the territory of that. I just want to explore the territory of whatever that thing is and get to know every nook and cranny and look under the logs and look under, you know. I'm not sure exactly what causes that other than just like an innate curiosity. And then there's probably a little bit of blend of like wanting to be enough, like we all do, and failing in the typical ways of sort of being enough as society told me. So I was like, okay, well, if I'm going to succeed in some weird way, I didn't go to college and stuff. And like, I don't know, I did bad in school or I am awkward in these ways. Then it's like, well, then I have to really succeed in this huge way and have this significant thing of like a National Geographic photograph or like go to space or do these big, big things, because it's like there's probably a little bit of, yeah, I'm trying to like fill up that hole of like trying to be enough by being significant. Because, you know, if you're weird and you're successful, then it's a good thing you're weird. And if you're weird and you're not successful, maybe not such a good thing, societally at least. So I think it's a combination of that. But when I look at myself as a little kid before maybe some of that came into play, I was super curious then too. Like, so there's a definitely like a pure part of that that's just innate curiosity and desire to learn. Like learning is probably, yeah, it's like my driver, my favorite thing. So, you know, I can go so deep into a subject, and then what's more exciting to me than going even deeper is learning something new, because that learning process is so much faster. Some people might say that's, you know, jack of trades, master of none, and that's a bad thing. But for me, it's been a huge positive because I can mix the, you know, different components of photography and business and investing and public speaking, or like all these different things kind of blend in ways that you might not expect. And so yeah, exactly. I definitely believe in like living kind of laterally and exposing yourself to things that you don't need to even that, but just that you like improv comedy or yeah, if you're a programmer and you do improv comedy, you'll be a much better programmer, which makes no sense until you do it.
I love that. Yeah, there's a lot that is arising in me to share. And yeah, let's see. It's so funny. I'm caught up on Eric Fisher, who is another teammate at High Existence. When you said that last piece about improv and programming, he's a programmer. You know, he used to work at Facebook on design and all this stuff, and he's building out the new High Existence community. But he also loves improv, and these are two like major things that he loves. So I just found it so interesting that you brought that piece up. And one thing connected to the jack of all trades thing or master of none. I think there's this real value. You were just alluding to it briefly there. When we get really immersed in a scenario or in a domain that we love and we really, like you saying, pick up all the logs and just explore it so thoroughly, there are these surprising ways in which that whole the lessons that we've gathered from that domain cross apply into other domains, and those cross applications can become competitive advantages for people against those who might not have developed or had experience in those worlds. And so I feel this way. I mean, I have a lot of interests as well, but particularly with magic, there's this whole like real sort of dynamic that comes really intuitive to me that I can apply to my understanding of media and how all of those things work. And there's lots of other ways that these things can be conceptualized. So there's real value in cross-pollinating and sort of porting insight from one domain into another domain. Now, it doesn't always work. You know, it's like that's to be sure. It doesn't always like cross-apply, but there are some gems that really can create leverage. So I think that's an important note. And one other thing, this is another sort of interesting piece that just arose on this last part, and that's you were mentioning this portal and this another Eric Weinstein, who's a luminous mind. He's launching a podcast actually this month called The Portal that I think will be a very interesting thing to listen to. But before you said that, one of his ideas was really sort of flaring up for me to share. And it's this idea, I'll add this in the show notes, but it's about this difference between excellence and genius. And it's borrowing this analogy of the adaptive valley that is used to describe certain dynamics within evolutionary biology. But if you imagine a hill and you want to get on to the top of that hill or this mountain, then you develop certain capacities, certain strengths to get onto the top of that hill and maintain your place on that hill. Now, that is what is described as excellence. Now, in the mainstream world, going through the traditional trajectory, going into doing well in school, then going to college, then working for a big company and just ascending the chain, that whole path is what you can consider excellence. You know, it's like climbing up that ladder. And what it sounds like for you, you were sort of precluded from doing that. You weren't good at school. You didn't go to college. You had a hard time getting a job. So you didn't even have that move. You didn't have that option. So you had to go out and seek other hills to climb. So where a lot of people are busy putting their attention on climbing the hills and trying to get up, you went the opposite direction and started to really explore other territory. And I think that's just an interesting idea for anyone else who's listening who doesn't feel like they did well in school or feel like they didn't go down the correct path because they weren't good at, they didn't have the skills that are validated within that school system. That does not mean you don't have incredible brilliance and deep, you know, they're probably remarkable things within you just waiting for the right context to emerge. So continue exploring, find your own path if the ones set out for you aren't jiving and aren't really, you know, supporting you in exercising your gifts. I just think that's so important.
I think the greatest advice maybe ever is follow your bliss, because it encapsulates so much. The Joseph Campbell quote, it's just, that's, man, there's so much to that.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah, and he also mentioned a thing later on in his life. a revision, and I forget the context that he responded to a question with this, but he also said, follow your blisters.
That's awesome.
Think there's a connection here, I think, because, you know, and I don't think when he said, you know, follow your bliss, that it's this hedonistic, oh, it's supposed to feel good all the time.
Yeah, it's different than pleasure.
Yeah, it's this North Star sort of big dream kind of orientation, you know, where it's this thing that it really excites you and lights you up, but isn't necessarily easy.
Mm-hmm. You know? That's a great point.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you about this new concept that you've been exploring, this Taoist sense of working with opposites. What's been alive for you there?
Yeah, so basically I've been really fascinated about, you know, the idea of how often, it's kind of the same idea of like the bigger the goal, the easier it is to achieve. There's a lot of things in human nature where as a society, because everyone naturally moves one way, it creates massive opportunities by going the other way. Mm. So kind of the Taoists would, and I'm just getting into this now, so I'm sure some people listening know a lot more about this than me, but there's an ancient art of like push hands, and you know, it seems like you would just try to push the other person over, but you put your hands hand to hand, and then you're standing on these poles, and so you're trying to get the other person to lose their balance. And so the thing is like that not pushing and like being flexible is the way to be the best at that game. So giving in to things and letting them push through you and lose their balance is much better than applying force to force. So I'm definitely super curious and just exploring where is it possible to delay gratification or to move things to a longer time horizon than most people are considering. I think there are some modern examples of that. I think Amazon is one of those, for better or worse. But Amazon, Jeff Bezos very intelligently decided not to make any profit for a long, long time. And then now just recently, he decided to crank the faucet. And now they're just, you know, Amazon's eating up the world. And he's now the richest person, even though he lost half his fortune. So he would have been the richest person by two if he hadn't lost that. So, yeah, so there's some different time frames. And so a simple example, there is the book, The Black Swan, and a great example Nassim Taleb gives of this is that if you have a deck of cards, since we're both into magic, I love its example, and every card that you drew, you got paid $10, except if you drew the Ace of Spades, it would cost you $1,000. Would you draw another card?
Would I draw another card?
Yeah, so everyone that you draw gets paid you $10, except if you draw the Ace of Spades, you lose $1,000.
Yeah, I draw another card.
Why is that?
It feels like the likelihood of me pulling the Ace of Spades is so low that it's not, you know, the risk isn't that high.
Yep. So, and that's what most people would do. And so there's a lot of analogies in real life where people do that, but that's actually there's a negative expected value to that play.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of things in politics that happen that way, and in economics. And so really what you would want to do is be on the other side of that, which is you would pay $10 to draw a card. And then if you draw the Ace of Spades, you get paid $1,000. That version is profitable. The version that we just talked about a second ago, you actually lose money over time. And so even like in the stock market today, you can buy out of the money, they're called, out of the money put options. And those options, the pricing indicates that the market thinks that we won't have another downturn like we had in 2007, 2008 for like another 100 years. And except for that, we have one of those much more frequently than once every 100 years, you know, like yeah. Once every 10 to 15 to 30, but they're increasing in frequency. So that's an example just on the investing side, just because it's an easy example to talk about of actually you can literally buy a put option, right? And it's going to cost you money every single month. But when the market goes down, which it will because it always does, just don't know when, you can end up making a ton of money. But, you know, beyond money, I'm just curious about things like, okay, what kind of things can I apply in my life? How can my meditation practice be, or my fitness routine, or how can I be with my friends and family in a way that I'm investing time and energy in a different kind of game than most people are playing? So kind of like we talked about the pleasure versus pain, a little bit of that instant gratification, but what if more often I chose the painful route that was investing in a better world, a better me, that my family and friends and colleagues are better off? You know, what would the world look like, I guess, if our human minds were tuned a little bit differently in that respect?
I love it. And this whole thing is bringing up the idea of misdirection for me. And for those who aren't magicians, the idea of misdirection is you sort of wielding someone's attention against them. You know, they sort of, you do something to put their attention on one thing, meanwhile something else is happening under the surface. And I think this is happening all the time in the world. There's no actual magician present. It's just these tendencies of where our attention goes. So often people, their attention is hijacked, and that causes them to miss out on things because they're so consumed by the other thing that they don't have the bandwidth to even notice what's going on. And so I think being able to, part of this, the skillfulness in this is being able to recognize and notice when your attention is being hijacked. You know, are you watching the, you know, 24-hour news channels and they're spurring all this outrage in you? You know, do you understand that they're leveraging these like deeper mechanisms to, you know, they understand that conflict will draw attention because in an evolutionary environment, it's a very significant thing to pay attention to. There's this, you know, if the fight is breaking out, oh, I might need to run or get into the action, or this might shift the whole landscape of the tribal power dynamics. So there's this hypernormal stimuli that is being sort of used against us. Similar with social media and things like this, there's these ways of drawing our attention into things. And meanwhile, you know, the question that I like to invite is, what are we missing while we're so sort of sucked into these other things? You know, is it possible that this is a spectacle and the real thing is we're missing it somehow? So it makes me think of that, and it also makes me think of this Alan Watts, this concept I first learned from him, which is the law of reversed effort. And so this is just another way of describing it, like you shared with that whole push hands thing. And it's the idea that if you're in a body of water and you're trying to float, if you're thrashing around, it's going to make it really hard for you to float. But if you just stop and relax in this counterintuitive way, somehow you then float. It's this art of you know, skillfully, you know, being effective without trying. So I think there's also this piece that's connected to this idea in some parallel way that is the absence of trying to engineer something in a certain way and sort of being more open and available. And I think that is a disposition that a lot of people have a hard time deploying because we have such tendencies for control and all of that. So very interesting subject. So much more to explore in that domain.
I think to tie it back into the luck piece, yeah, too, I think there's an element of when you're external to what's going on in the hypnosis or the misdirection of society that you're talking about, then, you know, if you do set a goal or you have something that you're passionate about or that you want to do, it's like there's these oscillations that are putting the pieces where you need them, and then you can go, oh, okay, here, now that piece is in the right place. I'm going to go ahead and grab that piece and put it where I need it. And then, you know, society will move in another way, and you go, oh, here's this next piece. I'll put that one where I need it too. But if you're in it, you can't do that because all the pieces are moving together. You don't have that oscillation that you're able to perceive as separate from you, which it really is. And use to your advantage, basically. And I mean, I think a lot of the most successful people throughout time have totally done that. They're separate, you know. If you look at Elon Musk or even Nikola Tesla or Warren Buffett or these people, it's usually they're just like they have enough time to themselves where they understand that they aren't the system and they can look at the system externally and they can see that those things are happening. And so clearly, it's like it's basic and simple to them once, you know, they're not caught up in society. And one thing I try to do that Elon definitely is a proponent of is first principles thinking, which mm-hmm. I think helps with luck a lot too, because for him, he literally just sees if it's physically possible to do what he's trying to do. So he's like, I want to go to Mars. Let me just do the math of if it's possible to escape Earth's gravity well with rocket fuel and a rocket that weighs this much, and what would need to happen. Is that physically possible? And then if it is, then he's going to go do it, because there's nothing that could stop him because the physics work. And so often we stop ourselves because of stories, because we live in stories. You know, that's like kind of maybe what we are. But yeah, so we get so stuck in stories. It's kind of a nice backing where, like, I know I've seen people set goals of, like, you know, having a big house, or meeting a certain human being, like, you know, like meeting Elon Musk, or you know, throwing a big concert, like they want to throw like this big concert they have in their head. And then it's like, literally, that's what human beings do. And yet people sort of feel this belief that it's impossible, except for like houses are for people. Concerts are put on by people for people. And like another person that you could meet, like that's people interact, like people meet each other. That's what we do. So it's funny how often people's beliefs about what's not possible are literally tied to things that are fundamental to what human beings do. So kind of a reset button to exit all of that is just say, is it physically possible? Like, is there anything in physics that's preventing me from doing what I want, achieving this thing, or having this passion, you know, happen? And if there's no physical reason why not, then there you go.
Yeah, inject a little healthy doubt in one's ability to accurately perceive their self-concept and their actual true capacity, you know?
Yeah.
It's like we have so much more in us than a lot of us give ourselves credit for. Some people give themselves too much credit, and then sort of, you know, life smacks them in the face enough times until they become a bit more humble. But for those of you who feel like there are some things that you really want to do and it just feels outside of range or impossible for you to do it, you know, why not you? Why not try? Maybe how do you know that you can't do it? Maybe it's worth a shot. Maybe it's worth seeing what happens. Maybe the desire to do that thing at all is really just a thing to drive you closer to something else that you can't see from where you're sitting. You kind of have to go on that path. So
I like that a lot.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, I want to wrap up here soon, but I'm really curious. You know, I shared earlier, Eric is quite multidimensional, and you know, I haven't. You know, we get to catch up every now and again, and in the past, man, maybe it's been a couple years, you've started this thing called Red Therapy, which I find really interesting, and it's really become a success. So, can you tell us a bit about what you're doing with Red Therapy, what, like, who it's for, and what value is to be experienced if someone was to purchase one of your units?
Yeah, for sure. So so Red Therapy Company is a company I started a couple years ago, and basically it came out of a passion for looking for ways to boost energy as my wife and I were expecting our first child, and I had kind of this lifelong fear of not getting enough sleep. Like, I'm kind of an asshole when I don't get enough sleep. Or not kind of an asshole, I'm like a big asshole. So I didn't want to be an asshole to my new baby and my wife and myself either, you know? But I was like legitimately terrified. Like, I didn't even want to have kids because I didn't want that to happen. So, you know, I know I make light of it now, but it was, you know, it was a genuine fear. So that fear definitely drove me to like researching everything I could possibly do to boost my energy. And so that if I had lack of sleep, that wouldn't be a killer. But also, like, how could I optimize my sleep and energy levels? And then rewind back to like the 1990s, my stepmom had neuropathy, like nerve pain in her feet. And she had these red light LED custom feet thing made, where she would put her feet in there and like it would help her nerve pain. And it's just red LEDs. And I was thinking, like, there's no way that works, but I'm not going to tell her that because I don't want to ruin the placebo effect. And then periodically, when I've just researched something that was going on with me or a family member, I keep coming across lasers, or, you know, like Dave Asprey's book, he was talking about his shoulder was locked up and this trainer shined a laser on his shoulder and his shoulder let go. And I was like, what do you mean a laser? Like, you shine a laser on your muscle and it does something? And so this hit kept happening. And then I really did a deep dive on what was going on. And it turns out that there's actually a lot of science and it's backed up. And so there's over 2,000 studies on red and near infrared light therapy and the biological effects that it has. And basically, when you shine red light, either from the sun or from a laser or from LEDs onto your skin or your cells, they actually produce more ATP. So they took human cells and actually put them in a petri dish and shined red light on the cells, and they could measure the increase in nitric oxide release and then also ATP generation. And they figured out it was because nitric oxide gets stuck in your mitochondria and basically gums up your mitochondria at the binding site where oxygen is supposed to go. So it turns out there's that binding site is called cytochrome C oxidase, for those really interested in that. And it's a chromophore, meaning it responds to light or color, and that wavelength, right? So basically, red light has the property of, if you shine it on tissue, like if you put a flashlight in your mouth when you're a little kid kind of thing, and you can see it on the other side of your cheek, you're doing red light therapy essentially, because the red light photons can make it through your tissue, whereas the other colors can't. So even if, like, on your cell phone right now, you turn on the flashlight, the little LED on the back, and then you put your finger up to it, you can actually see your finger is red. The reason it looks red is because the red is making it all the way through your tissue, whereas green and blue and all that are stopped at the skin level. So basically, it can go deep into your organs, your muscles, your tissues, and cause a stimulation of ATP production, which is energy itself. So that's why I, you know, came upon it looking for all this energy stuff. So I was really interested, and I wanted to do this on my whole body. I thought, this is so cool. I want, like, to, like, douse my body in this good stuff and, like, make sure that my ATP is good all the time. And but the devices were, like, thousands and thousands of dollars. Some up to, you know, like a full body bed is like $120,000, and there were some smaller devices, but they're still very expensive, in like $4,000, $3,000 range. And so I basically have a background with my dad is an electrical, has a PhD in electrical engineering, although he became a programmer. But when I was little, we used to do all kinds of things with LEDs and add lights to all my toys and, like, all this kind of stuff. So I had enough electrical knowledge to be dangerous, I guess. And so I prototyped up a, you know, basically the most powerful red and near infrared light therapy device ever created, and then had a factory in China, an electronic lighting factory, make me a prototype. And then I was actually able to do that whole process for less than the device's cost, to making even a prototype. And so I thought that was awesome, and it was a really fun project. And then all my friends wanted them, because I wouldn't shut up about how cool red and near infrared light, and they're like, bring it over, we want to use it again. Like, I have this thing going on. I have poison ivy. I want to try it on that. I have this. I want to try it on that. And Kyle, my wife, she had eczema on her arms from being pregnant. Like, it changed her skin a little bit, and she had eczema on her arms. And the very first time we tried it was actually on her, because I didn't have anything active going on to try it on. And then, we tried it on her arms, and it worked. And it, like, got rid of the eczema the first time. Not that I can promise that'll happen for everybody, but it worked for her on the first try. And there are plenty of studies about it improving eczema, but it usually takes, you know, like 4 to 6 weeks, not like a single treatment. But we saw that happen, and it was cool because we just treated one arm, and then the other arm still had it. So we had like a split test. And then we took pictures before and after, and then we did the other arm like 2 weeks later to make sure there was nothing else that was affecting it, and sure enough, it went away. So we're like, wow, this is incredible. So yeah, it's been pretty serendipitous, because everyone started wanting one, and so I thought, well, I'm going to launch a website. And then if I can sell kind of one of these per day, I will be happy. Like, this will be like a good business, and it will be worth continuing, and I'll have enough money to innovate and make new products and stuff like that. And so then it's just really taken off, and in a, you know, taking action and being bold and proximity is power kind of a situation. Here in San Diego, there happened to be an author who's basically the world's foremost expert on red near infrared light therapy. Number one or number two, there's a Harvard researcher, Dr. Michael Hamblin, who's probably number one, but Ari Witten is his name, is probably number two, and he happens to live in San Diego. So moving to San Diego ended up being, you know, a very, very good move when I had no idea what was going to happen with this business. Mm-hmm. But when I found out he was into this and I'm so into this and we live in the same town, it's like, hey, dude, let's get coffee. So it's like getting proximity with, you know, the people that are doing what you're trying to do. Mm-hmm. Kind of, that's so important. So I followed my own, you know, my own advice on that. And so we got together and he was like, you have no idea how good your timing is. I'm about to launch a book on this and I really think this is about to catch on. And I told him about my device and the specifications. And he says, it sounds like you got a perfect device with just the right amount of power. It's better than any device out there right now. And it's cheaper. He's like, if that's true, then your device will be my number one pick in the book. So send me a device and then I'll test it and make sure. And so he tested all the devices and sure enough, mine was the best. At the time in the book and everything. And so he launched the book and promoted mine as like his number one pick, which is incredible. And then we are just, yeah, just growing like crazy and constantly innovating. We launched another product and then we have a bunch more in the pipeline. So we're looking to kind of move red and near infrared light therapy more into the mainstream.
Hmm. I love it. Yeah, that was really, that was a level of detail I haven't heard before in terms of how that whole thing emerged. So fascinating, so cool, so crazy that in one application it got rid of your wife's eczema, and that it's just
You kind of, I forget, I didn't really answer your question either, but like what are the applications? So there's a lot where if you think about just the power, if each cell in your body has more energy, then your body can already, like your body already knows how to heal itself essentially. Instead, it runs out of energy. Like a lot of people have, that's what the theory of aging is. You age because there's more happening to you, more impact, more stress than your body is able to recover from each day. So it's just like a net negative. So if you have more energy, it actually is anti-aging. So they have, you know, they've done studies at universities and everything where they take pictures of people before and after, and you can Google to see these, but their skin actually gets younger. It helps heal injuries a lot faster. So from like surface stuff like cuts, like actually in other countries, like in Japan or Russia or some countries, if you go to the ER and you had a big cut, they'll immediately just put a red light on your cut. Like they've been doing that for a long time. That's something that's like tribal knowledge kind of. And now we're figuring out why that works. But yeah, and then it just has overall health benefits because you have this this boost of energy. It also helps with thyroid hormones and like any kind of hormone, because your glands are bunches of cells. And so if they have more ATP to do their job, they can produce hormones better. And so you have all these crazy effects. It has like amazing effects on the eyes. It's in FDA trials right now for curing macular degeneration, which is the number one cause of blindness. And then there's no other cure for that at all. And it's pretty cool because it's just red light. It's like a spectrum that's in sunlight. So it's totally safe. There's something that we're already used to. It's kind of cool to think like our bodies evolved. The theory goes that, you know, we were outside so much more and we were around the campfire every night, that's why these kind of pathways exist and why this is so helpful. But that was one of the things in the transition to modern life that we got rid of, was we're not really in light very often. And if we are, it's artificial light, which is missing the red and near infrared frequencies that do this exact effect. So the food, you know, processed food is one of the pieces, but processed light or artificial light is one of the things too. And it's becoming clear that light is actually a nutrient that we need. So anyway, I could go on. I'm obviously very excited about this topic.
I love it. So fascinating. And I love how it ties into this overarching subject of your, you know, it's like, You can say, oh, he met Elon. That's a bit of a fluke, you know, that the way that happened. And then you hear the Branson story, and then really start to wonder, well, maybe there's something to this. And then you hear this other story of the way you connected with this author, and then getting your piece promoted, or your company promoted, and just getting that timing so right. Really, like, you have to. The skeptics have to start to, like, you know, really begin to recognize that there's something else going on here. And this isn't to say it's like something even woo-woo. You don't even have to take some law of attraction type stance around it. It's just a practical, almost mathematical, like geometric thing where you're putting yourself in proximity, you're getting out there, you're taking action, and you've sort of got these insights around, you know, having these bigger dreams and believing that you can do it. And that sort of cocktail is what's supporting and creating these experiences of serendipity and profound luck. So I hopefully, if someone's been listening to this, if they were skeptical at the beginning, they're beginning to shed some of that doubts that they might try some of these things on for themselves.
Absolutely. That would be my hope. You know, these are just principles I've stumbled into, if anything. And yeah. I absolutely think that they are universal, not something particular to me. I feel very grateful to have had the experiences to illuminate these for me. But I hope that other people apply these.
Yeah, I don't know, Eric. It might be the four-leaf clover that you just have in your wallet.
Yeah.
That's really doing all this heavy lifting for you. I mean, I think that's probably it.
Could be.
Yeah. Well, so if people want to check out your photography, they can go to jamesazur.com. Where can they learn more about Red Therapy?
It's redtherapy.co instead of .com. Or you can Google Red Therapy Company. And then, yeah, you can see, and then the book is by Ari Witten. It's on Amazon. Just Red Light Therapy, Ultimate Guide, something like that. But it's by Ari Witten, and it's a really good book. So if you're just interested and you're not sure if you're ready to buy a device yet or anything, definitely check that book out, because he goes into the history, all the different applications, you know, basically like how NASA uses it and how it became what it is today. So it's definitely an interesting book.
Great. Well, we'll have links and all that good stuff in the show notes. Eric, thanks so much for making the time, sharing these stories with us, and just jamming with me today. Really enjoyed it, and hope our audience enjoys it as well.
Absolutely. Thank you for the opportunity, Mike. This is a lot of fun.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the High Existence Podcast. If you enjoyed that, then please subscribe so you don't miss another episode. And if you want to go one step further, you feel very generous today, then a review and a rating would be really helpful for us to keep the podcast healthy and keep getting great guests. Until next time. Thank you for listening to the High Existence Podcast. The Future Thinkers were such great guests. I love their wise, balanced answers to all of the questions that Jordan posed. Thank you for the support. I wish you well. See you on the next episode.